The first Academy Awards ceremony in 1929 was held at a private dinner at the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood with an audience of less than 300 people. Tickets were $5, or about 70 bucks in 2017 dollars. And 15 awards were given, honoring artists, directors, and other participants in the film industry of the time. And the ceremony ran for 15 minutes. Now we make a season out of these long broadcasts that include the awards, the red carpet, the pre-red carpet speculation and post-show analysis, even the so-called Manny Cam, to devote time to scrutinizing actresses down to even their manicures. Ugh, it's a lot. Just recently, Meryl Streep made headlines with her Golden Globe speech, and given that between tonight and the Academy Awards, the presidential inauguration sits on the calendar, I imagine that we're going to hear some politics that night at the Academy Awards, too. Indeed, awards season is in full force, and while most of the focus will be split between who won what and whether or not it's well-deserved and who wore what, the major awards events, and perhaps Hollywood itself when dissected, is really a microcosm of social issues, far-reaching, perhaps issues that are bigger than we are often willing to consider. It's easy to let the glitz and glamour of the industry and its celebrations become all that we see. And let's face it, some of that is compellingly good fun. But the issues that intersect in our conversations about awards, they matter. The issues that arise in films, the issues surrounding who makes the films and who stars in them and what characters are in them and who works on the set and who wins the awards and which films become mainstream, well, all of that matters too. Tonight, that's what we aim to explore, those conversations around what these awards really represent and why they've become such spectacles, about actors using acceptance speeches as political platforms, infamous boycotts, and why conversations about representation in film and behind the scenes really, really matter. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
You heard the woman. It's the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight and sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. Well, tonight we're talking about awards season. But of course, this show being what it is, we're not going to just talk about what films deserve to be recognized, although we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. But we're going to talk about the many considerations around Hollywood and its biggest award nights, right? From pay equality for actresses and actors to the number of female directors and producers to why the people we don't see on screen and on nominations lists sometimes makes a bigger statement than perhaps we're willing to acknowledge, and so much more. So all night, I will be so delighted to hear from you as we go along. So feel free to give us a call, 312-981-7200. But if you're feeling a little bit radio shy, and that's perfectly okay, you can text that number. And you can also find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all that good stuff and contribute to the conversation in that way, too. We are going to have some super smart people in here tonight talking with us about some of these issues. We're going to be talking about representation in Hollywood, a history of political speeches and boycotts from actors. And we will be, of course, talking about some of the films that are raising eyebrows and some that everybody expects to win. So lots to do tonight, as ever. So we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to get this underway. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
And this is a film for dreamers. And I think that hope and creativity are two of the most important things in the world, and that's what this movie is about. So to any creative person who's had a door slammed in their face, either metaphorically or physically, or actors who have had their auditions cut off or have waited for a callback that didn't come, or anybody, anywhere, really, that feels like giving up sometimes, but finds it in themselves to get up and keep moving forward, I share this with you.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And as you might have guessed from hearing Miss Emma Stone talking just now, we're talking all about award season. But this show being what it is, of course, we're dissecting it within an inch of its life and talking about all of these narratives around it and all the issues that it comes with, because it is so much more than just a red carpet and which film won and which actor won and all that. There's really a lot to it, and we're going to be digging very deeply into that tonight. And joining me now in studio is Jordan Reeves. He's the founder of Video Out, which you can visit at videoout.org, which is an online library of stories told by the LGBT community. Welcome to the program, Jordan.
Thanks, Amy. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for sharing part of your Saturday with us. We're most grateful to you for that. So, you know, when we talk about diversity and inclusion in Hollywood, we usually are talking about female directors or producers and representation there. Or we're talking about race. You know, last year, the Oscars So White hashtag and social media campaign really, really pointed out a lot of racial disparity in Hollywood and in films. But what we don't talk about as often, I think anyway, is representation of the GLBT community. And there's a study that I read recently that's saying that this is, in fact, getting worse, that in fact, members of the GLBT community and characters that, right, like all representation of every single type are, it's in fact going backwards.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, it's not surprising to me. I think it's sort of a trend we're seeing in a lot of places right now, not just in movies or in television, as evidenced by perhaps our president-elect's cabinet choices. But I won't digress into that now. I think, you know, to stay on topic, we've got a lot to talk about. But before we move further, I just want to get something out of the way.
Sure.
I am a white man talking about diversity, and I realize that some of the privileges that I've experienced sort of permeate industries, including Hollywood. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. Like, I understand my perspective. Additionally, I also want to say that an award doesn't necessarily mean that a movie or a performer or a television show is good.
Sure.
It does typically mean, however, that the awarded, the recipient of the award has done something good in their respective medium, or has made some sort of contribution to that medium.
Yeah, validation in some way.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So I think it's important that we understand that award ceremonies are largely subjective.
Sure.
So it's up to us as a community to rally behind important work oftentimes and amplify it and highlight it in a way that award shows may fall short. So all that said, I think it's still important to discuss the necessity of diversity in these award shows. But to really do that, I think we have to understand the history of the entertainment industry.
Certainly, certainly.
And, you know, I am not an expert on the history of the entertainment industry, but I did take a few classes, right?
Sure.
We all did at some point.
I took a class. I know the thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if you'll allow me, I'd like to just briefly recap. But for the sake of this conversation, I want to rely on the old trusty person, William Shakespeare.
Uh-oh. So what's about to happen?
We'll start with him. Yep. Just stay with me for just a second. So during Shakespeare's time, women were played by men.
Definitely.
It was a given.
Yeah, definitely.
Mostly, if not almost exclusively, they were white men. So that was just a given. And ironically, and this is a side tangent, Shakespeare in Love was... If you don't know that movie, you should watch it. It's a plot
Gwyneth
about
Paltrow,
with Gwyneth
right?
Paltrow, yeah. But the plot is about this this woman who disguises herself as a man to play a character in one of Shakespeare's plays.
So, at the time of its original production, that would be a man dis- a man playing a woman who's disguising herself as a man.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So, and then the irony there is that this movie won 7 Oscars. So, you know, if Shakespeare could have seen that, or maybe some people in Shakespeare's time, I'm sure that they would roll over in their grave. But anyway, we have this industry that's dominated by white males, and it existed even through the advent of the major motion picture, moving pictures. It actually wasn't until 1939, that's 323 years after Shakespeare died, that Hattie McDaniel won for the role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
There's a lot of interesting stuff attached to Gone with the Wind, because there's the de Havilland law, who was...
What is that?
Olivia de Havilland played Melly in Gone with the Wind, and she forever changed the face of labor in California. There's a California in the labor code, I think it's like section 2855, that changed forever, because the idea of like a studio owning a person, they weren't counting things like weekends or maternity leave or things like that against your time in your contract. So even as recent as like a year or two ago, Rita Ora even summoned up that. But the de Havilland law really played a big role in Johnny Carson's career. And I mean, it's been a...
Wow.
So there's a lot of kind of sub-narratives just to Gone with the Wind. Not only did we see a person of color winning an Oscar, and we also have like all this law, like all this legal stuff that changed as a result of
Thank God
actors.
For Gone with the Wind,
know, right?
Right. So interestingly enough, Octavia Spencer, who is someone who's really relevant now... Mm-hmm. Is only the 5th person to ever win Best Supporting Actress. The only 5th, the 5th black woman to win Best Supporting Actress.
Right.
And she won in 2012. And another irony here, she won for her role in The Help, which is about the plight of black women in the 1960s.
See, I think that's really interesting, because there's almost, not almost, there's definitely like 2 parts to this, right? There's the actors, there's the... Well, 3 really. There's the actors, there are the people in power in Hollywood, like producers and directors and all that. But then there's also like the characters written for people.
Sure.
Right? And I think in the case of the GLBT community, a lot of times we see like a person represented as like a big stereotype. And then I think it gets into like representation and like the, you know, the message for young people.
Yeah. I can see that. You know, I think a lot of the roles where LGBT Q people are represented on screen, at least recently, haven't really played the stereotype. They've tried to be true to form. They've tried to really tell a story of a real person. So you know, we can think of the Alan Turing movie, or Harvey Milk, Dallas Buyers Club. You know, there's some really, really great films out there. And you know, gay and lesbian women and men have been represented more recently, I think, than trans people.
Are
a lot more. They were represented, or they were receiving awards a lot sooner.
Well, it'll be interesting to see the influence that the show, the TV series Transparent, has.
Oh, yeah.
On the film industry, because
I think that's
you know, I mean, anytime we. Well, like when Caitlyn Jenner was on the cover of Vanity Fair, suddenly people were having conversations about what it meant to be transgender.
Totally.
In a way that, like, people that maybe didn't know anyone who was transgender were suddenly having these conversations, and that conversation was everywhere suddenly. So it's, you know, it seems like it always just kind of takes a pioneer to go there, to do that. Not that Caitlyn Jenner was the first person to do that, but certainly the first person on Vanity Fair who was transgender, as far as we know, right?
Yeah. And it's also interesting that, you know, when Sam Smith won the Oscar for original music back, was that 2015, I think
so.
The James Bond movie, even in his speech, he said, "I'm the first openly gay man to win this award." And he wasn't, of course. You know, plenty of gay people have won Oscars.
Sure.
Going back to the 1970s when the director of Midnight Cowboy won. But it's interesting that Sam Smith, a gay person, didn't know that. It's interesting that not a lot of people knew that. So it was only the people who were sort of steeped in the industry called him out.
Right.
People were like, no, there have been others.
Right. And that's interesting too, right? Because it seems like, I mean, we're in a more open time now where people can, for the most part, come out safely. But there's always those stories that you hear about kind of the golden age of Hollywood of people that came out and or much after their death, right? A lot of people are like, oh, everybody knew that person was
Tab
gay.
Tab Hunter, Rock Hudson.
Rock Hudson, right? I'm just blanking on his name. The TV lawyer was Perry Mason.
Perry Mason, right?
I think everybody on set kind of was like, oh, right, we all knew it, right?
Sure.
That was a thing. He was out to us, but that was such a... That was a not for the best career changing, you know, game changing career move at the time.
Sure,
it could be really detrimental.
Sure, sure. And now, you know, I'd be interested to hear an argument where it is neutral. You know, I wonder if it is still detrimental in any way. Like, you know, there's a series on Netflix called Sense8. And one of the characters plays an actor, and he doesn't come out because he plays these macho straight man characters in his roles. So I wonder if that's actually a real life thing. I don't know enough to answer that question, but you know, if there is an actor or an actress who is struggling with the choice to come out, and they decide not to because they're afraid of their roles being taken away from them or not being cast in a certain
and acting is like that's such an interesting profession because it's kind of the only place where very openly and legally you can be discriminated against for body type or race or all you know any litany of things. You can really just say, well, this role was written for, say, a black man over 6 feet tall. I can't give this role to a tiny 5 foot one woman. It's just not the role, right? So it's an interesting profession. And to me, it's very interesting how one's personal life, like, it shouldn't matter at all what,
totally,
you know, what you do. But nonetheless, it can kind of, I think, perhaps maybe influence a casting director or influence an audience or something like that.
Isn't it interesting, too, though, that if you are an LGBTQ person, you may be prevented from playing a role as a straight character, but it hasn't stopped the industry from casting cis people from playing LGBTQ roles.
Yes.
So it might in some cases go the same way, but I think the percentage of people playing LGBTQ roles are the percentage of straight people playing those gay roles is a lot higher than the other way around.
Right. I mean, like, immediately I think of Eric Stone Street in Modern Family, right?
Yeah.
Who's playing the role of Cam. And then I think one of his big film role right after the height of that show, I remember a lot of film critics kind of talking about it's hard to adjust to seeing him as this macho straight guy.
Yeah, exactly.
As we got to know him as Cam.
Right.
Which
is
really, really interesting. Well, so tell us a little bit about Video Out while you're here.
Sure.
Because I know we do have to go to break here in just a bit, but I want to tell people all about what you're doing and, of course, an event that you have coming up right here in Chicago tomorrow.
Yeah. So in the spirit of this show, in the theme of the show, the important thing for the LGBTQ community is to share their stories. As Meryl Streep said, it's the actor's one job, but it's also, as Bayard Rustin said, all of our responsibilities as LGBTQ people to encourage everyone to come out. And that's what Video Out wants to do. We want to encourage everyone to share their coming out story. So we're here for an event this Sunday at Center on Halsted, where we're encouraging the entire Chicago LGBTQ community to come and share their story with us. We're going to record it. Actually, your production company, Strange Ways, is going to be there.
Indeed. Very honored to have helped bring it to Chicago. And you're going to be visiting a lot of cities as the year unfolds, but very, very glad to help bring it to Chicago for sure.
Yeah, we're so happy to be here. So if you are LGBTQ, or if you're an ally and you have an important story to share, come join us on Sunday. You don't have to have anything scripted. We are about authenticity. We want to hear from your heart. So just come and be a part of what we're doing on Sunday.
It's going to start in about 15 hours from now.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Very, very exciting. That's at the Center on Halsted, which is a beautiful facility. It's lovely. And if you're not familiar with Video Out, head to the website. It's videoout.org. And it's a fascinating collection. It's an online library of stories. And it's so lovely, and I've been telling people about this event, and some of them are so funny and joyful. Some are, like, supportive and touching and sweet, and the kind of, you know, you just want, like, gosh, I hope everybody has that experience when they come out. And then some of them are quite heartbreaking and tough, and you realize, like, people have really had some very unfortunate, you know, responses to coming out.
Yeah.
And all of those stories kind of make up the whole collective story, and they're also important to tell.
No one can win the Oscar for playing your story better than you can.
I love it.
So come share your story. Absolutely.
Lovely. Yeah. Well, if you are interested in going to this event tomorrow, head to videoout.org/Chicago, and there's a link there on the page. You can book a time slot, do your thing, or just show up. Whatever.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Absolutely.
Well, Jordan Reeves, thanks so much for being with us and helping us start this conversation tonight about this very complicated. I mean, we always take on big things in this show, and they're never easy to solve in 2 hours, but nonetheless, we always try to. So thank you very much for being with us tonight, and we hope that you are enjoying your time in Chicago.
I love it here.
I'm glad. We'll take you. You can move here. It's all good.
Who knew that playing an ex-convict would take me all around the globe? It just goes to show. I thought it would be Queenie, Will. I thought it would be my character from, Karate Kid. But it's Cookie, who spent 17 years in jail for selling crack. Okay! So the world loves real. Thank you.
Seven 20 WGN, Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. It's a clip from an Empire acceptance speech there. Very funny, very, very cute on that one. But a valid point that she raises nonetheless in that one. We're talking, as you might have guessed, all about awards shows tonight, and Hollywood in particular, because it's kind of their Super Bowl, right? When the Oscars and the Golden Globes and all the good stuff. And certainly we have been thinking about the Golden Globes a little bit more and in a little bit different way this week, because Meryl Streep, in her acceptance speech, she took on without taking on the incoming presidential administration, and she made her acceptance speech rather political, as we've seen other people do, from boycotts to calling out to a particular community, things like that. This is a thing that happens at a lot of awards ceremonies, a lot of awards times when we have, you know, when an actor has a platform to do so. But what does it do, right? What difference does that make? Does it actually move the needle? Good question, right? So joining us now is Peter W. Stevenson, who is a writer at Washington Post covering lots of things. Peter, you cover video and politics and all kinds of things. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me about this history of how actors have taken on political causes. You know, the backlash, I think, sometimes is how can this actor speak for something political? This is, you know, not the actor's job. But nonetheless, if you do have a very public platform, you do have an opportunity to reach a lot of ears. So it is something that's come up a lot.
Absolutely. And it's been the case going back way before awards shows even started. I mean, the first big case of this in the 20th century, at least, was in the 40s and 50s. There was a blacklist created where a lot of people in Hollywood were accused of being communists at the time. The Red Scare was in full force. And that was kind of the big first wave of political kind of people getting angry at celebrities for having the temerity to voice their political views in public. And that dynamic has kind of since then only expanded, especially as television and things like that have become more ubiquitous, and these celebrities have more of a chance to get their voices in front of people.
Certainly. And it seems like there's kind of two categories of the acceptance speech that has a political slant to it. There is something that's in response to something cultural that everybody probably knows about. And then there's the type that will give a shout out to an organization or a cause in hopes that more people will know about it.
Right, absolutely. And a great example of that is one that I think a lot of people now probably don't even remember. When The Godfather came out and Marlon Brando won the Oscar for Best Actor for that, he actually declined the award and sent an Apache tribe member named Sachin Littlefeather in his place to go on the Oscars awards show declare that he wasn't accepting it and draw attention to the way that Hollywood had treated Native Americans over the years, especially in Western films. And who happened to be the host of the Oscars that year? John Wayne, a guy who appeared in a whole lot of Western films. And he actually came out later and read an apology on behalf of the organization, apologizing for what was then a very controversial statement about a subject that a lot of people probably didn't know a whole lot about.
Isn't that interesting? And I feel like that very topic had... It came up again. I want to say it wasn't it an Adam Sandler movie or something like that? It was like a comedy film. Just in the last few years, I think that like a bunch of people walked off set and there was a whole resurgence.
He had hired a bunch of Native American actors, and they were shooting a scene in which there were some jokes made kind of at the expense of Native American culture, and a bunch of those actors walked off the set in protest, and it really kind of created a negative buzz about that entire film up until its release.
Right. It also seems like the I don't want to say the approach necessarily, but kind of the touch that differentiates the actor's political speech from maybe a politician's, right, is really the way they'll kind of say the thing without saying it, right? So in Meryl Streep's case, she clearly was criticizing the incoming administration and some cultural issues surrounding it. But she didn't really go there. She didn't name it exactly or point to exact people. She was just kind of talking about the moment that we're in. Is that, you know, it seems like if you're going to do it, just go there. Just do it, right? Is that sort of to protect something yourself politically?
Well, I think a part of what she was probably looking out for was the inevitable backlash that she got. I mean, it was pretty obvious that she was talking about Donald Trump for most of this, especially when she referenced the New York Times reporter who he had very clearly imitated on stage at one point during the election. And it was interesting because there's a calculation, especially when you go after President-elect Trump in particular, that he might come after you on Twitter, which did happen the next morning. And so I wonder if there was a calculation there about what his response might have been and some attempt to mitigate that. But we can't be sure, of course.
And so what is your opinion on the effect that these political speeches really have on the public?
It's interesting. One thing that's for sure about these speeches is that they create a conversation. The next day, a lot of people are talking about them. People are kind of split into two groups on these. People who think that it was great that Meryl Streep came out and made this speech and criticized the president-elect, or in a broader sense, among many of these speeches, you know, brought something to light that wasn't being talked about. But there are other people in this particular case who think that this kind of thing is exactly why Donald Trump won. The idea of Hollywood liberals going after the blue-collar worker who, you know, the guy who blue-collar workers chose to be their president would seem to indicate a disconnect between Hollywood and those people who voted for him. As far as actually measurable impact, it's hard to say. There's a little bit of polling on this. A CBS News poll in 2014 had people saying, you know, 61% of people said that Hollywood had too much influence on American politics. Only 26% of people said it had the right amount, and 9% of people said it had too little. A 2007 poll from Fox News asked who had better ideas for solving America's problems, politicians or Hollywood. And a majority of people, 52%, picked politicians, while less than 10% of people said the Hollywood celebrity. So that suggests that celebrities might have a voice in creating a conversation about an issue. But when it comes to actual policy prescriptions, it's possible that they're a little bit lacking.
Right. It is interesting, though, the way we've seen celebrities take on big issues, right? I'm thinking of the way Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy took on anti-vaccines and took a stance against that and really rallied a lot of people. So it is kind of an interesting and nuanced line, right? You do have celebrity.
Absolutely.
Therefore, you can rally a lot of people and reach a lot of people. But sometimes, you know, as a lot of people, you know, the backlash against them was, well, your actor's not scientists. Who are you talking about? You know, why are you saying this?
But to counter that, there are times where it has had a real direct measurable effect on a policy issue. Take a look at The Cove. That was a 2010 documentary that came out about dolphin hunting practices in Japan. When that came out, there was a huge, you know, that won an Academy Award, and the producers of that movie held up a sign during the Academy Awards urging viewers to text a phone number to get more information about it. And the next year, when that dolphin hunting exercise happened again, there were tons of cameras. There was a lot of PR. There were international, you know, discussions at the kind of actual political level about whether this kind of thing was real. And other documentaries in a similar vein kind of, in a sense, took down SeaWorld. You know, SeaWorld had to completely reevaluate its Orca program because of Hollywood action. You know, that was more directly due to a CNN documentary,
right,
not an awards show per se. But those conversations that are started in Hollywood do sometimes have a very direct effect on policy and business and things like that.
Right, right. And then there's been a lot of, certainly a lot of actresses lately talking about women's roles in Hollywood and equal pay. You know, there was the Arquette that did it, and then immediately in the post-award interview kind of botched it and stepped in it a little bit by kind of kept going and saying, going off on a tangent a little bit, but I think that's an interesting piece too. But on some level, it just feels like you can, you know, lots of actresses can go to awards shows and talk about equal pay, but at the end of the day, there has to be some kind of, you know, actual action. And I think maybe that's where there's not a lot of awareness from the public. It just seems like there's a lot of, you know, pontificating with very little action behind it.
Absolutely. And part of the conversation here is, should Hollywood celebrities be making these speeches? And it's interesting, there's kind of a culture around, especially people in society who are seen as having a voice and having wealth at the same time, that they have an obligation in some way to dive into the conversation. And some people think that the wealthy and the connected and the quote-unquote elite do really have an overt obligation to do this. And some people on the other side say that just because somebody is a film star, that doesn't necessarily give them a platform for things like this. And that divide, I think, is really visible in something like Meryl Streep's speech from last week, when you saw people who, you know, the negative reaction that came out to that,
right,
basically accused her of not having the right to have that platform. And it's interesting to see Hollywood celebrities navigate the debate over whether they should even have a voice in these arenas.
Right, definitely, definitely. And then there's always, sometimes there's that backlash, like I think of Gwyneth Paltrow, right? She did the thing about trying to buy food on such a tiny budget and trying to raise awareness of how difficult it is to live on essentially like a food stamps program. But it backfired terribly on her because she really was a bit tone deaf about the way she did it, buying like organic bok choy and, you know, things like that.
And the folks who feel that, you know, there really is this gap between the elites who do not understand the average blue-collar American, seized right on that kind of thing as a typical example in their eyes of why Hollywood is out of touch with the rest of America.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it seems to be, it's an interesting time, right, for celebrities, because it used to be pre-social media, you know, the best you could hope for was if you wrote a fan letter, you might get a signed photo back, right? Or you might encounter them at a restaurant or something. But now there's an expectation that our celebrities are quite accessible to us through social media. And I think that's playing an interesting role too, as we saw this week with, immediately after Meryl Streep's speech, we saw President-elect Trump right away say overrated and like immediately respond to that.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, there are two sides to that coin. You know, on the one hand, a Meryl Streep supporter might say, well, the president-elect shouldn't attack her. You know, she has the right to speak her mind. But at the same time, the president-elect responding to this speech brings it that much farther into the public discourse and the public conversation. And people who might not have even been watching the awards show all of a sudden are very aware of this public fight that's going on, that is all of a sudden two sides arguing with each other instead of one person just making a speech.
Right. And we've seen some really interesting social media campaigns that have mobilized people and in fact changed the way the award ceremonies went. A little bit later in the show, we're going to talk a little more about it, but I'm thinking in particular of the Oscar So White hashtag from
absolutely,
you know, that did have a real impact.
And one of the speeches that people remember most from the past 15 plus years of Oscar ceremonies, it was when Halle Berry won the award for Best Actress and was the first African-American woman to win the award, and dedicated the award to all of the people who she felt should have won it before her. That was a moment that I think really connected with a lot of people because of the emotion of it, because of the historical impact of it, and because it was so clearly something that was so meaningful to so many people.
Definitely. It's very, very interesting to kind of analyze the politics of the actors politicking, right, and all of that, and all the pieces around it, and how, you know, both failed and successful attempts, plus adding in the social media element now. It's really very, very interesting.
And of course, with the social media element of it, there is a little bit of a PR element of it, too, with the expectations that are set on actors, with their desire to. I'm not, of course, accusing any actor of using a cause to further their own career.
Sure.
But there is the perception of that from some, especially when, you know, people kind of seize on causes. I mean, just look at the election. You saw, you know, a lot of people in Hollywood made these kind of anti-Trump videos leading up to the election, and that casts Hollywood in this very kind of liberal light that some people dive right into, and others feel like they get a lot of backlash for and want to stay away from.
Yeah, that's very true. That's a very good point. It is really also very interesting. Well, everybody, head to WashingtonPost.com to follow Peter W. Stevenson. Of course, everybody, follow him on Twitter. Peter, he's same there, too, at Peter W. Stevenson, following all things political and video. Really, really wonderful work there. So, but look for this, the story in particular, the long history of pointed political speechifying at Hollywood award shows. Very, very interesting read. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back here in just a bit on 720 WGN to continue this conversation about all this nuanced stuff around awards shows. Back in just a bit. WGN, it's Amy Guth. It's the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking all about all the stuff swirling around awards shows, right? It's so much more than just the glitz and glamour and the red carpet and all that stuff. We have been talking about actors making political speeches, using that moment of winning and using the acceptance speech as a moment to make a political statement. And, of course, we've been talking about LGBTQ representation in Hollywood. Coming up after the news, we're going to talk about some issues surrounding racial inclusion in Hollywood, because we saw last year with the Oscars So White campaign on social media, that did change things a little bit this year, but it also opened up, I think, a lot of eyes to show some other communities that were grossly underrepresented in Hollywood. And then we're going to be talking about female representation in Hollywood and talk about a lot of films that we're probably most likely going to see cleaning up at the Oscars. So we're going to be doing all of that good stuff. And, you know, we were just talking with Peter W. Stevenson from The Washington Post, who covers video and politics and all that good stuff, and talking about some political statements, and he was talking about some early ones. Some of them are really interesting. We talked about Marlon Brando in 73, where he was just like, nope, not going to do it. Or 72 or 73. Anyway, and sent someone in his stead to shine a light on the plight of Native Americans in terms of how they had been treated by Hollywood. And also there's a couple other that are of note that are really interesting. George C. Scott for Patton. I just combined those in my head. George C. Scott said, I'm not going, but in particular, he described it as a quote meat parade. And he said, then I don't want any part of it. So he refused for such an iconic role, right? When he played General Patton, he was like, nope, whole bunch of nope on that one. But also Dudley Nichols, who won for Best Writing in 1935 for The Informer, he boycotted the 8th Academy Awards ceremony because of conflicts between the Academy and the Writers Guild. So there's always like stuff, right? There's always interesting kind of behind the scenes stuff. Personally, I think I don't mind actors making like a little bit of a political statement. I thought Streep's speech this week at the Golden Globes, I thought it was powerful. I thought it was important. I think a lot of people really heard it and felt it. And it was widely shared, widely quoted. And as our last guest pointed out, it did continue after the president-elect responded to it on Twitter. And so it has continued on a little bit, which is really interesting. But sometimes I find it a bit awkward when the celebrity, and this happens like at music shows and this happens at all kind of stuff, but when they'll like get up and say, they'll reference something in such a strange and lingo-y way that you don't even know what the heck they're talking about. You know, they'll just kind of like talk about the plight of a city but it's like a city no one's ever heard of, and everybody immediately starts Googling it, and it'll start trending on Twitter as everyone's trying to figure out what the heck that person is talking about. I feel like the side mentions are not as useful. Like just say this is a city and this is the issue and I want to stand up for it, instead of just a slight mention. I think the like side mention is not as useful.
What do you think about when they bring someone else on from a cause to accept their award for them? For example, like Miley Cyrus won maybe a Billboard Music Award and brought a homeless youth mm-hmm. to come on and accept it for her because she has that Happy Hippies Foundation mm-hmm. for homeless youth.
I don't know. I mean, the crotchety old lady in me just says, like, this show needs to be shorter. Can
yeah.
we have less speeches and not more of them? But you know, I try to be a compassionate human being and believe everyone deserves to be heard. So I get it. I don't mind it.
Do you watch awards shows?
Usually. And if you don't watch them now, you have no choice to, because it's on Twitter, right? Everybody, I think that's really interesting about social media right now, is that there are so few moments when we actually gather around a television anymore. Mm-hmm. It's usually a sporting event or an awards ceremony. Or a giant news disaster.
I knew I wouldn't have to watch because all of the highlights would be all over my Facebook feed the next day.
Yeah.
And I was right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I love, 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 love a really beautiful, heartfelt, emotional acceptance speech, especially by someone kind of winning for the first time or something like that. I'm thinking of Roberto Benigni when he won for Life is Beautiful, and he stood up and he said that he would make love to everyone in the audience. And when Cuba Gooding Jr. won, and he was so excited, he just couldn't contain it. Like, those are so touching, and those make me cry. And I think that's kind of a more authentic experience. But there's nothing wrong with people that have won for the bajillionth time, like Meryl Streep, and get up and just say, hey, I'm this is not my first rodeo, and I have something to say right now, and I recognize that I'm a legend and I have a platform. I think that's okay too. Anyway,
standing around on the set one day whining about something, you know, we were going to work through supper or the long hours or whatever, Tommy Lee Jones said to me, "Isn't it such a privilege, Meryl, just to be an actor?" Yeah, it is. And we have to remind each other of the privilege and the responsibility of the act of empathy. We should all be very proud of the work Hollywood honors here tonight. As my friend, the dear departed Princess Leia, said to me once, take your broken heart, make it into art. Thank you for it.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. That, of course, very touching words from Meryl Streep about both her experience and her friend. And I think that's very lovely advice from the late Carrie Fisher, to take your broken heart and turn it into art. For sure, that applies to lots of things, not just tonight's topic. We're talking all about Hollywood and awards shows, because as we have seen, they're certainly not just about the red carpet and the statues anymore. There's so much to it. It used to be, you know, the most personal stuff was coming from Joan Rivers, saying, who and what are you wearing and what's going on, right? And it was all that kind of stuff, and these wild questions she was going to throw at people on the red carpet. But indeed, it is we're in a time in which a lot of conversations are happening. There's a lot of change in the world right now. And so we're having a lot of conversations. And as last year, if you will recall, last year when the Oscar nominees were announced, this campaign on social media launched very quickly in response, and it was called Oscars So White, because there was a great lack of diversity among the Oscar nominees and winners. And it did a lot to help African-American representation on screen, certainly, and we see that reflected this year, for sure, in films that we're seeing, both Golden Globes and Oscar nominees and other places. So it did work, as we were talking about with our last guest. Sometimes actors are pontificating, sometimes it actually works, and sometimes with the role of social media, real change can happen. But the downside of that campaign is that while it helped one group, it certainly showed us that there were a lot of other underrepresented communities in Hollywood that were not being heard. So please welcome to the show, my very next guest who is joining us in studio, which we're very, very glad about, Henry Godinez, who is a resident artistic associate at Goodman Theater and a theater professor at Northwestern University and a Public Voices Fellow through the Op-Ed Project. Welcome to the program, Henry.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for being here with us tonight.
My pleasure. We appreciate you
sharing your time with us. So you've been writing about this topic, about how the Oscars So White movement really, while it did some good, it really opened the door to show us the lack of inclusion for other communities.
Yeah, I think actually what it did is that, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but it just showed in relief the absence of so many other faces in Hollywood. You know, I guess I'm particularly interested in the lack of Latino representation in Hollywood, especially given, I think, the demographics in this country and what they are, how they're projected to change in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Right, right.
So it seems odd to me. It's what I've been concerned with as an artistic associate at the Goodman. My job has been to champion new Latino work and develop Latino audiences for the Goodman, you know, which is a theater that really sees itself as the city's theater, you know, and represents the city of Chicago. And so it's important for us that the work on our stages looks like the city of Chicago. And I guess in some way I feel that Hollywood should do the same.
Right, right. Well, I think that representation piece is so very important. I remember reading an interview with Gina Rodriguez, who was talking about growing up and seeing these stereotypes of Latinas that were like, you know, thugs and or this like very saucy, sexy kind of figure. And she internalized that very much and felt very limited by I can be these are the two things that I suppose my people are, and felt so limited and hurt by that as a young person just beginning her career. And if not before,
you know, I think part of the problem is that, you know, the bottom line is that Hollywood is about the bottom line. And so they care about, you know, the people that buy tickets to see the movies. And when the people that are making the films, the people that are giving the green light for the films and the television shows are not from a particular culture that they're trying to represent, it's easy for them to go to the stereotype, you know, to what they believe the majority of the public, how they perceive a particular mm-hmm. culture.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have gardeners and you have gangbangers and you have drug dealers and you have prostitutes and maids. But clearly that is, you know, not who all Latinos are, but in some ways it's the easy go-to sort of representation.
Certainly. And well, you mentioned a moment ago the kind of the business piece of that, which mm-hmm. is, and the demographic piece of that, and like the size of that alone should alert Hollywood that not only is this about like just the right thing to do really, but right. but in fact there's a business piece attached to that that's economic. In a piece that you wrote recently at Latino USA, you can find it at latinousa.org, you made note of this. You said Latinos are said to comprise more than 30% of the U.S. population by 2060, and going on to say, with a disposable income of $1.5 trillion in 2015, the Latino community clearly has the purchasing power to make an impact at the box office.
Definitely. And, you know, I think that advertisers, marketing companies, a lot of other corporations know that. And so you've seen a lot of advertising campaigns that have been really reaching out to the Latino community and have been focusing on ad campaigns that are specifically targeted to the Latino community. Even, you know, you may have seen TV commercials recently that are sort of in Spanglish.
Mm-hmm.
I know on the radio I've heard an ad that was in Spanglish, and I remember thinking, oh my God, that's so awesome. Because that is the reality of I think, the Latino community in the United States today. You know, it's a community that is, I think, largely acculturated. Certainly the younger generations are, you know, maybe their parents immigrated here, maybe their grandparents immigrated here, but they've grown up speaking Spanish, or maybe like me, speaking English, you know, in the street, English at school, and Spanish at home.
Mm-hmm.
So they are of two worlds, and I think that's something that Hollywood needs to catch on to, too.
Well, So as you're saying this, I'm wondering if the advertising world is able to understand and work with that and embrace that, what do you think the barrier is in Hollywood? Is it the people at the top and not being able to look around and deal with bias because of a lack of diversity at the top, or is it something else?
You know, I think it's a little bit of all of that. And actually in that article I touched on something that, you know, could, you know, be fleshed out a little bit more, and that's I think, you know, Hollywood would love to have a one size fits all sort of film or television show that would appeal to all Latinos, but the Latino community is a very diverse community. First of all, there is no Latino, you know. Right. There are Mexican American and Puerto Ricans and Cuban Americans. I mean, you name it. There are 20 some odd different countries that are represented under this umbrella that mm-hmm. we call Latino. And we're here for a variety of different reasons. Some are here for political reasons, some socioeconomic reasons. So it's challenging, and I get that. I totally get that. But I also think that the answer is not to try to find the silver bullet or to try right. to find that one movie that we do or that one TV show. You know, it's that... and it happens in the theater sometimes. You know, I think that you see across the country sometimes a major regional theater, not unlike the Goodman, will say, well, we have our Latino slot. You know, we will do our Latino play. And for a long time that happened with the Black community. People would say, we have our Black play, right. you know, for the year. And I think that has changed. And, you know, the great thing about the Goodman is that, you know, we have been committed to diversity and inclusion for a long time.
For sure.
You know, and I think that's the key, is that you need to consistently be programming diversity. And then the audiences will feel like, oh, gosh, yeah, I see myself in that. That's totally my story, even though I'm not Latino or I don't speak Spanish or I'm not Black.
Right.
But I think that what great theater and great films can do is tap in to a universality that is human, first and foremost, you know, and that all people can relate to.
Truly, truly. Well, I think that's a kind of a theme that came up a lot during the election, as we were talking about groups of voters. You know, there's a lot of angst around saying the woman vote or yeah. the Latino vote or what, you know, there's no the
no,
for any person.
Not even the woman, as we found out.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. And I think that's a very, you know, interesting part of this as we're, you know, as you so wisely pointed out, that it takes planning from the top, from the beginning, and constantly having this thought of programming. Right. I think it's interesting how theater companies will challenge, kind of force people to challenge their bias. I read, I think it was in Seattle or Portland recently, a production of The Little Mermaid, the Ariel, the mermaid, was Asian.
Yeah.
And initially there was a, well, that can't be,
right.
you know, the same kind of thing that we saw when Annie was cast as like a young Black girl,
yeah.
right? Same kind of thing. And because the only answer to that is, why can't she?
Well, you know, I think the great thing about Hamilton, which you can't find a ticket for, is that young audiences are going and seeing that George Washington is Black.
Yeah.
And so young Black people are going to see this incredible musical and going, wow, there I am. I am, in fact, a part of American history, you know, and that Hamilton is a Puerto Rican. And, you know, and the truth is that after about 2 minutes, you forget.
Mm-hmm.
And you really just see American history on stage, and you see the challenges, the difficulties, the nuances of what our young country went through. And I think that in time, if Hollywood had the courage to do that, you know, the same thing would happen. They're starting to. If you saw the last two Star Wars movies...
Yep.
You know, the two kind of the two young male leads were both Latino,
mm-hmm.
Oscar Isaac and Diego Luna, Diego Luna being in Rogue One. You know, and there was nothing about those two roles that were particularly Latino or had to be Latino.
Right.
It was never spoken to. It was never addressed. And in the case of Diego Luna, he has a dialect, whereas Oscar Isaac doesn't. So, you know, it's like it's right there in front of you.
Yeah.
You proved it. Keep doing it. Just keep going.
I do think that's really interesting when people are really thoughtfully trying to make us confront what we each consider normal.
Right.
You know, when filmmakers say, okay, just because the script says a woman walks by with a dog, she doesn't necessarily have to be white.
Not at all.
She can be any woman.
Yeah.
She can be, that can be anybody that walks by of any ability, of any race, of anything. I think it's really interesting. And I think, I feel like anyway, it's going to take some really concerted effort and dedication to doing that, to normalizing all kinds of people on screens for us to get there. I mean, and I say that and I'm like, how is that coming out of my mouth in 2017?
Yeah, right. You know, it's something that we've been wrestling with for a long, long time. And you know what? It's not just a cultural thing. It's people that have different abilities, you know?
Yeah.
I did a reading, a staged reading at Steppenwolf a couple of months ago of a really popular play, Pulitzer Prize-winning play called Art. And it's a three-character play. And typically it's done with three white actors, three normal actors, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We did it with three deaf actors, and it was done in ASL. And then we had three hearing actors that simultaneously voiced the roles, and they were African-American and Latino and white. And it's, you know, it was awesome. It really just takes having a little bit broader view of the world and the possibilities, as you said. I mean, I believe that what it does is it only adds, you know. I think that there is inevitably some kind of reaction. I remember, I wasn't around, but I've heard the stories that when the Goodman started doing A Christmas Carol many years ago, I think it's 30 some odd years ago now, and we first started doing, you know, what used to be called colorblind casting. Now we actually prefer to call it color conscious because it does make a difference. The Cratchit family, you know, was composed of all different ethnicities and colors, and initially there was, you know, there was some reaction from the audience. Now, you know, Tiny Tim is black, and Mrs. Cratchit can be Asian, and people, it's like you never hear a word because it's accepted. It's expected, actually, in that production.
So what do you think needs to happen next for us to really get there? You know, we're making progress. There is progress. You're saying there's audiences that are now looking beyond, you know, what they could not look beyond at first.
Right.
So what is the next thing needed?
Well, I really do believe that the next thing that's needed is are more people of color in positions, in the higher positions of authority and of power. Because I think those are the people that are going to be more willing to take the risk and to go a little bit further and to push the boundaries a little bit more. But actually, even more important, I think that those are the people that are going to be able to identify authenticity, you know, that are going to be able to see that a story or representation is not just a stereotype or is not something out of proportion, but is in fact authentic. And then I believe that audiences, whether they are of that particular culture or whatever that may be, they will sense the authenticity and the truth. That's what audiences pick up on.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what speaks to audiences when there's something so undeniably human, it transcends all of those things.
Absolutely.
Whereas I think this, when we see like tokenism and stereotypes, when we see that we know it, we feel it, even if it's not someone from our own group, we know it.
Yeah, no, it I think that kind of tokenism or stereotypes, they come with a kind of veneer. It's almost like a shell that you as an audience member, your compassion, your empathy, your imagination can only penetrate it to a certain extent. But when it's authentic and truthful, you attach to it, you know, and you really identify with it in your own reality. Because I really do believe that in the end, there are so many more things that we have in common as human beings than divide us or that differentiate us. And that's why, you know, so many audiences of color, Latino audiences, African-American audiences, Asian audiences, consume Hollywood films regardless. And I believe that's a two-way street. But the people at the top need to understand that that's true.
Yeah. You made note of that number, which I found staggering in this piece that you wrote for Latino USA. And that was this 2015 Hollywood Diversity Report, which is really interesting. It's available online if you want to Google it. It is very eye-opening. But in particular, you noted that 92% of senior management in film studios, white, while 96% of studio heads, white.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, at the end of the day, everybody has biases and everybody has a concept of what normal is to them.
Right.
And that's, to me, why it's so very important to have diversity at every level, because it's impossible. You can only speak for your experience of what you have experienced in your life.
Exactly.
And even, I think, even good intentions.
Absolutely. It's not a malicious thing.
Right.
It's so subconscious.
Yeah.
You know, that you just automatically sort of gravitate toward what you know. That's just the reality, I think, of human beings. And I, you know, maybe it's because I'm used to working collaboratively in the theater, and, you know, but even if they had a consortium of studio heads, or if they had a collective, you know, if there were more voices in the room, but power is power, and power is a hard thing sometimes for people to relinquish or share. So,
right. And when threatened,
oh, yeah,
people react, right? That's, I think, a theme we've been seeing the last few months.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and so, but let's go there. Indeed, you know, a lot of conversation has shifted in the last several months due to the election and the result of it. And do you feel that has changed the path or the conversation around this issue?
Well, I think so. Yeah, definitely. I think it's made this effort and the need for inclusion that much more urgent, because I think we're starting to see that truth can be relative and that facts can be made
whatever
up.
You want them to be.
whatever you want them to be.
Right.
So it's really, really important now, because the people that then get to tell the stories are the people that have the power. Now, I think that human beings are incredibly creative, and I have no doubt that if that happens, if that continues to go in that direction, that people will find other ways to tell stories, and they will find other ways to get the truth and the facts out. That's what creative people do.
That's true. Creative people always find a way
That's right.
to do their creative thing.
Have to.
And you know what? I think it's interesting, too. There's a lot of writing around the idea of the creative community's response to different political administrations. And I think somebody at one point even started looking at female comedians and how these very iconic female comedians, most of them rose during a very controversial Republican administration, which is kind of interesting. So it remains to be seen who shall emerge from the incoming.
Oh, my goodness. So many people, no doubt.
Right. It'll be very interesting. It is a very interesting time that we live in. I think we can all agree on that, no matter how you voted. Well, Henry Godinez, thank you so much for being with
us tonight. You're so welcoming.
Time flies. I wish we could talk about this for hours and hours. But thank you so much. Resident Artistic Associate at Goodman Theater and Theater Professor at Northwestern University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
This is for all of the women of color, and colorful people whose stories, ideas, thoughts are not always considered worthy and valid and important. But I want you to know that I see you. We see you. It is an honor to be on this show, Black-ish, to continue expanding the way we are seen and known, and to show the magic and the beauty and the sameness of a story and stories that are outside of where the industry usually looks.
So 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. You're just listening to Tracy Ellis Ross making her acceptance speech for an award that she won for her work on the show Black-ish. And very, very powerful words that she said there, very important ones. Well, we have been talking this evening, as you might guess from that clip that we just played, all about awards shows. But we're not just talking about the movies and the shows that are featured in them, but in fact, all these very complex issues and narratives that circle around them. We started talking about representation, certainly, both from the LGBTQ community as well as we were talking about racial inclusion and diversity as that we see in Hollywood, and we were certainly also talking about political moves as we look at acceptance speeches from way back, not just Meryl Streep in recent days at the Golden Globes, but way, way back. So lots of things to consider when we talk about awards shows, certainly. None the least of which is the work itself, right? That is a thing we certainly have to think of, because there's always conversation around that. And usually it's like, of course that one won because it's so wide appeal, or of course that one because of this. You know, there's lots of sometimes eye rolls if the movie you didn't want to win wins and things like that. And there's no pleasing everyone, of course, but we have a really interesting lineup this year as we look at Oscar nominations, as we looked at the Golden Globes. We have a lot that was based on theatrical scripts, right, on plays. We have a very clear response to last year's Oscar so white criticism that there wasn't enough diversity and inclusion. So it's a really interesting awards season this year in particular. So joining us now, regular contributor to this program, is Katie Reif from the AAV Club. Hi, Katie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you? Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk with you. I think when we last met, we were talking about horror movies around yeah. Halloween time, and I watched all of them that you recommended, and they scared the bejesus out of me in the best way possible. So those were excellent
picks. Yeah, I was going to say, did you leave the light on afterwards?
Absolutely. Absolutely, without a doubt. So how are you feeling about the Golden Globes as we're moving into Oscar time?
Well, you know, I mean, I liked La La Land, but I'm not quite as up on it as some of my colleagues are. So moving into the Oscars season, I would say that, you know, maybe I'm not quite rooting for the front runner, which is La La Land.
Right. A lot of people are feeling really conflicted about La La Land because, right, it's great. It's a great movie. It's uplifting. You leave.
Sure.
It's very touching. I think I said lovely and gutting when the credits started rolling, you know.
Yeah.
And in all the right ways. And it's beautiful. We haven't seen a movie like that in a long time. But I think there's some people that are just like, I just can't totally drink the La La Land Kool-Aid.
Sure. I mean, for me, when I'm watching it, gosh, I have a lot of really complex feelings about that film because I like it and I walked out of it feeling uplifted. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought maybe people say it's going to bring back the musical.
Right.
And I think about, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers kind of musical numbers. And I think it's a complex question because it doesn't necessarily live up to that, you know.
Right.
It's not all Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling aren't singing and dancing on the same level as the people that were doing in the 50s and 60s, but the question is, are they trying to? So it's a complex question.
Right. So we also see a bit more diversity this year, and as we're looking
yes.
at Oscar nominations than we have in years past. I think a lot of that is due in part to the Oscar So White campaign that we saw last year.
So.
Yeah. Who do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think the film that maybe that's another tough question because I think the film that maybe is coming to, you know, is rising to the top this year is Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
And that is maybe rising to the top and is getting attention it wouldn't have otherwise, perhaps because of that controversy. But I think it is a completely worthwhile, beautiful film. I voted it my number one film of 2016 in our end of the year poll. And I think it's just like a really poetic piece of filmmaking that I would hesitate to say it's because of the Oscars so white, because that makes it sound like a token pick when really it's a great piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, I think that's a front runner for a lot of people. I've heard a lot of people pick that one, and a lot of people also say, I didn't know what to expect walking into that film, but it blew me away. I think it surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, I actually saw it. I hadn't heard anything about it, and then my boss at work, our film editor, told me, hey, you should go see this movie Moonlight because it's a really good film. And I saw it, and it took me, I had to kind of collect my thoughts afterwards because I thought it was a really profound statement on identity. And I think it's a really empathetic film. And I think that's something that we could all really use these days when we're all very divided politically. We could all really use something that is very empathetic and just tells you something about somebody who maybe their point of view isn't always represented.
Right, right.
And it shows you their point of view in a really, like, profound way.
Well, I always think it's very interesting to watch creative work, particularly films and books, responding even very indirectly to, and even sometimes very subconsciously, responding to cultural moments. So I've been very interested to see what's happening in those two realms in particular, even though it goes into, I think, all creative work, but especially movies and books. I think you see it so clearly. You can draw those parallels. In your mind, who was just completely robbed and who was just overlooked, but maybe they do speak to a cultural moment, or maybe they were overlooked because they don't speak to a cultural moment?
Oh, wow. A movie that has made some waves on the indie circuit but isn't being recognized on a grand scale, who I think is really good. There was a film called The Love Witch. It's playing at the Jean Siskel Film Center right now. It came out in November, and it's playing again now. It's a female director. Her name is Anna Biller. She lives in Los Angeles. And what it is it's a film that sort of recreates the 70s style of exploitation film, but she remade it as a comedy. So she remade sort of something that could be considered kind of sexist, like a movie about a witch who seduces men and kills them, but she recasts it as a feminist farce.
Interesting.
And it's really good. And I don't think the Academy is going to acknowledge her, but I think they should, because she made it in a way that precisely replicates that 70s look, and it's playing on film, on 35mm film, at the Jean Siskel Film Center. I think it's playing this week still. It's been selling out all over the country, in New York, L.A., here. Just all these screenings are selling out. That's something that maybe has been overlooked by the Academy that is worth checking out.
Definitely. That's a great recommendation for that one. That's very interesting. And that sounds like no easy task, to recast an exploitation film to be both funny and feminist.
Yeah, but really, really funny. She made it really funny, yeah.
Well, you've never led us astray, Katie, so we're going to trust you on that one for sure. If
God, that's a burden, right?
I know. Such responsibility, right? But nonetheless, you steered us to greatness with your Halloween picks, so we're going to follow on that one and go see The Love Witch. Well, and then we move into the Best Director category, and immediately all the love we have for maybe some progress around diversity and inclusion really runs away pretty quickly, as we see it really just all a bunch of dudes, all about the same age.
Sure, all dudes. Yeah, all dudes. Well, it's interesting. There was the University of San Diego does a survey every year about women directing films. And the thing about that survey is that it's only the top 250 grossing films at the box office. So you're not really including the sort of fringes of filmmaking. But honestly, the top 250 grossing films, that's a pretty big net. And it was 7% this year, down from 9% in 2015. So it's actually dropping in terms of feature film representation for women who are directing feature films.
And why do we think that is? Other than, you know, the patriarchy. I don't know.
If I knew, I would fix this.
Right. Indeed.
Yeah, well, I mean, women are making some strides in television. I think television, you're seeing more female directors. Because, you know, you talk about women-led films and stars and stuff like that. But I think you really need to look at the writers and directors if you want to really get into who's running the show.
Right. And you're right. It has been, like, we are seeing some women doing some really powerful things in television right now, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially when you look at Amazon. Amazon is growing in power. And Jill Soloway with Transparent is really, you know, she's pretty powerful these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's, I mean, I feel like every time I look up, her name is in a headline because she's won something else for her work
right?
on Transparent. She's, yeah, quite powerful indeed. As we move into lead actor and lead actress categories, as we're looking at those for the awards that are coming up, I feel like people are very, and this is completely anecdotal, but I feel like there's so many people that are just so meh. I don't think anybody's feeling really strongly about people in that one this year. The most I've heard is Natalie Portman and Jackie, but still, even that, people are like, she was good, but it's okay.
She was good. She was good. And, you know, Emma Stone is a strong contender for La La Land, and I work at the AV Club, which is, you know, the Onion's pop culture wing, and all of my colleagues are very up on La La Land, and I don't dislike it, but I'm kind of, it's okay.
Yeah. Who's your pick for best actor and best actress?
I would put up Isabelle Huppert for Elle, which won a Golden Globe, and I was kind of surprised she won the Golden Globe for Elle, because it's a very challenging film.
Yeah.
It's a great film, but I wouldn't recommend it to everybody. And as far as best actor goes, anybody who played the main character... Moonlight is an interesting example, because you have three different actors playing the main character throughout his life, right? Mm-hmm. And so who is the best actor out of those three?
Right, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot on that one, right?
Right. Do you divide it up amongst those three people? Do you give the best actor award to all three of those guys? Because if I could do that, that's what I would do. I would give best actor for all three of the actors who play the main character in Moonlight, if you asked me.
I like that. I'm all for dismantling a system. That's okay. We can do it. We can share it around three people. Well, and so what are some other, maybe some actors that have just been completely overlooked? You're so in touch with independent films and films that are so high quality, but perhaps overlooked just because of, you know, a box office gross, something like that. What are the ones you feel really strongly about?
Well, a film that I think is going to get some minor awards love, but I think could get a little more, is Hell or High Water, which Taylor Sheridan, who acts in it, he also wrote the screenplay. It's an excellent screenplay. And listen, if you're mad about the government, you know,
it's the film for you.
If you think the government is taking away, the thing about Hell or High Water is it can appeal to both sides of the political spectrum. If you're a left winger or a right winger, no matter what, if you think the government is, you know, cheating people out of their fair share, Hell or High Water is the film for you.
Maybe it's the film that's going to unite the nation. Maybe.
Perhaps.
We'll see.
It's a good Western on top of it. And it's got Jeff Bridges in a really good performance, a cowboy role.
Right. And he is nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Mahershala Ali should win that for Moonlight.
Right. I think. I haven't heard anyone say otherwise. I think everybody's got that pick. For
he's
sure.
a very strong. I was a little surprised because Aaron Taylor Johnson was pretty good in Nocturnal Animals, but. Nocturnal Animals is sort of a film that, you know, it's a style over substance sort of thing, in my opinion.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, one that we haven't mentioned that I think a lot of people, it's funny because at first, when Manchester by the Sea first came out, a lot of people were real excited. And then it's shifted to this very kind of thing. Like people, it's like a very pastel reaction.
Manchester by the Sea has its own complications because, well, I mean, if we can draw a parallel to The Birth of a Nation, which came out earlier this year, it received a very strong reception at Sundance, got a standing ovation, all that stuff. Then it came out later in the year that the director had had a background where he had been accused and went to trial for sexual assault. Casey Affleck, the star of Manchester by the Sea, and to be fair, he's very good in that film. He is very good in that film. The AV Club, who I work for, actually voted that our best film of the year. He has also not quite to the same level. You know, never gone to trial, anything like that. I don't mean to say Casey Affleck has been accused of anything like that by any means, but he's got some sexual harassment allegations that have dogged him throughout his career. And that's sort of muted the awards response to Manchester by the Sea, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think there's also like the social media kind of backlash against, hey, I don't think, you know, here, let's take these two actors, both accused of things. And I don't think Casey Affleck is getting the same level of scrutiny.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say that he's not being held to the same level of scrutiny as perhaps Nate Parker was, the director of The Birth of a Nation. Yeah.
Right. So there's always so many competing narratives around all these things. Like I said at the top of the show, right?
It's so
just,
many.
Like people think it's just, oh, the glitz and glamour and the red carpet and the pretty statues. There's so much to it. And there's all this kind of backstory. And I think social media it really plays an interesting role because we don't. We don't often watch, or at least all of us together, watch television live anymore. You know, we all just kind of watch it when we watch it on Netflix. But award shows and sporting events and big disasters are when we're all looking at the TV. And so it becomes this second experience to look at social media because everybody's sitting there updating the same thing, which is really a fascinating thing, just kind of cultural moment to be in and to be able to watch with people in that way.
Yeah, and there's so many layers to it where you have the immediate reaction, and then you have the backlash to that reaction, then you have the backlash to the backlash. There's so many layers.
And then you have the think piece, and then the pontificator, and then you have the, there's all the things.
Absolutely, yeah, there's so many layers.
All the things. Well, thank you for talking with us about all the things, because indeed there are so many layers.